We're doing Parshat Vayeshev, but the time has come to pause and address a question which is relevant to all the Parshiot we learn, which is a question of how do we view the patriarchs, how do we view the tribes? And because this is probably the harshest Parsha with regards to the tribes, we see the harshest actions, the actions which our sages and the prophets speak very strongly against. Perhaps last week's parsha was equally harsh. We have to pause and really understand who we are talking about. If we said that the patriarchs were giants, if we said that they were people who had fantastic traits, they were people who merited tremendous prophecy because they were on such a high level, we wouldn't be doing it justice. If we learned the Braisa, based on which the Sefer Mesilat Yesharim is written, a Braisa quoted in the Talmud in Masechet Avodah Zarah, the Talmud describes the evolvement of how one builds one's traits and goes through the positive traits of modesty, the positive traits of kindness, the caring, cleanliness. If we go through all the traits that are listed there and then say, okay, the patriarchs made it to the top, they made it to great prophecy, and they were people who really had masters of their feelings and were in control and were really fantastic, fantastic human beings, we'd be far from doing it justice. So who were the patriarchs? Only a few years ago, there lived a rabbi who was getting into his car when the person who was accompanying him closed the door in his hand. And he didn't say a word. He waited until the car pulled away, and then when they rounded the corner, he asked the guy to pause, and then he pulled his hand into the car. And I could tell you other stories that I witnessed with my own eyes where people, one person by mistake burned someone else, and the person didn't react as though nothing happened, just so as not to embarrass the person. The person splattered, by mistake, a pan full of boiling oil on, down someone else's neck. And that rabbi was quiet. He didn't say a word. Nothing happened, right? Because he didn't want to embarrass the guy who did it. I was the guy who did it. I was dealing with a boiling hot frying pan filled with oil. It was the first time I was frying oil. And I saw I was burning the pans. I ran to the sink, turned on the cold water, and all the oil exploded. And I got burnt, and the rabbi sitting at the table had a bulk of boiling oil hit his neck, and he didn't react. I couldn't, like, I was sure it didn't happen, but my own eyes saw it. Like, okay, so if I told you there were such giant people, that's people who live today. And when they look back at people from 200 years ago, they say, we're worms compared to them. I could tell you that there were a few rabbis who I learned by who told me about their own mothers that in the month of Elul, they used to fast the whole month. And that every month, they would review all of Shas Mishnayos. Things that we don't do, us. We won't talk about the fact that they went to the mikveh in Russia or in Poland, where they'd have to actually chisel through the ice to go to mikveh. And you go to mikveh, you're not wearing anything, right? I don't know if you guys can imagine what that means. And they didn't come home to a house that was exceptionally warm. We won't talk about the rabbi who lived 400 years ago, who 300 years ago, he wrote his responsa with ink that would freeze on the quill. He spent his whole day under the covers, and he'd come out of the covers, write until the ink froze, then go back under the covers. This was their life. There are phenomenal stories of greatness, but if I told you about a man who was in Russian prison, the father of a friend of mine, he was in prison, and then he learned about circumcision, so he took a knife in prison and circumcised himself. No anesthesia. No. I don't know if he wants me to say, but I can tell you he lives in Alon Shvut. I can tell you. I've seen the person. So when we look at acts of bravery, we say, wow. But those acts pale by comparison to the acts of people who lived 200 years ago. And the people 200 years ago will attest that their acts pale by comparison to the people who lived 400 years ago. the generation of Rabbi Yosef Karo, if you're going to get to 600 years ago. So we don't understand a generation like that. When we look at the generation of the Gra or the Shulchan Aruch, we look at a generation where we just don't understand. We look at them, and to us, you tell me Rav Yosef Karo, you tell me Avraham Avinu, they're all somewhere out there, you know. But we have to understand that they're not. Meaning, take the biggest rabbi you could think of today, multiply him by 50 times, and then maybe you have Rav Yosef Karo, who was all of 500 years ago. Now, Rav Yosef Karo wouldn't argue on Rav Haigon, on a Rambam, on a Rosh. So you go 300 years back, and Rav Yosef Karo looks at them in awe and says, I can't argue with them. There's a famous story about a Hasidish Rebbe who lived about 150 years ago, who kept davening, Rabon Shalom, give me the capacity to be as God-fearing as Maimonides was. And one day he got his wish, and he stood frozen and couldn't move. He went out of his mind. He stood there and just couldn't move, frozen. And after a long, long while, he was able to bring himself to pray, or at least to think a prayer. Please, I can't handle this. I can't function with this. And he was lucky that it was taken back. Usually they don't do that in heaven. They give, they don't take. At any rate, when we look back, it's hard for us to appreciate. When you go back to the Rambam and the Rosh, you just go back 900 years and we don't even understand what we're talking about. I had the good fortune to learn by two Jews who would read a page at a time. I don't understand how you read a page at a time. I remember I once brought to one of my teachers an essay I had written, 10 pages long, and the rabbi does this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And he says, well, okay, fine. So I said, what does fine mean? Don't you want to read it? So he said, I did. So I didn't buy it. I said, what do you mean you did? Don't you think you should read each word? So he said, well, on this page, I think you elaborated too much on this point, and on that page, I think you elaborated too much on that point. Thank you very much. So I walked away shocked. If my eyes wouldn't have seen it, I wouldn't have believed it. When Rav Pesin Zatzal was ill, so his eye doctor told his family, you have to understand how frustrated he's going to be, because he's used to reading pages at a time, and now he's only going to be able to read sentences at a time. His eyes were going, he had Parkinson's, and he's not going to be able to read at the pace he used to. Now, when I learned by Rav Pesin, so he told me about the Maril Diskin. He was here in Israel. He lived 150 years ago. He told me that the Maril Diskin has students who record the following story, that he'd look at a tree and tell his students how many leaves were on the tree. And his students would say, Rabbi, we're not going to go counting the leaves. How are we going to know if you're right or wrong? So he said, here's how you'll know. Go pluck a few leaves off the tree, and then I'll tell you what number of leaves are on the tree, and then you'll see if I got it right or wrong. So he got it right. So Rav Pesin used to tell me, when he told me that story, he said, doesn't that make one feel like a worm? Okay. That's what he was saying. And when I talked to him, so I remember when I started learning, so when my rabbis used to tell me that the Avos, the patriarchs, were giants, I felt like, yeah, that's what they were taught, so that's what they're believing. But if you look closely, that's not what it says. If you look at the verses, I remember thinking, you know, they bought into this. I don't. So I'm not, you know, okay, fine. But after years of having the good fortune of seeing the giants of our tradition, of being close to people who were giants of our tradition, seeing their honesty, seeing their capacity to admit they were wrong, and their humanity, their willingness to be honest and straightforward, and on the contrary, their humility in hiding who they were. If it's Rav Pesin, who always said about all the secrets of Torah, I don't know what's written here. And when he passed away, we opened his books. I didn't, his children did. And they found on his, he had libraries filled with notes on the secrets of Torah, which he always said, I don't know what it says, right? And then when they opened his books in his Zohar, they found all the sides of the Zohar covered with footnotes, and his other books as well. And there are many stories about the humility and the modesty and the honesty of the leaders of the Jewish people. And so when you start seeing that, you start realizing, okay, these aren't people who would just buy into things. And when the first few nights that I learned by Rav Pesin, so I bombarded him with question after question after question. I was coming to him after years that no one would answer my questions in Jewish thought. And I bombarded him. I spent with him that night till midnight at least. And then the next night, and then the next night. And every question I'd ask, he'd bring out another sefer and show me where the answer is written. And then I realized, okay, he didn't just buy into this. He was asking questions his whole life, and he has answers. And then I started realizing, so maybe he also asked the question and didn't just say, well, the ones before me were bigger than me, and he realized and saw it. So this is something which you can hear, and over time, I hope you'll be fortunate enough to see it on your own. I can tell you, and it's not out of modesty, it's out of honesty, that I feel bad that you're hearing this class from me and you're not meriting to hear it from the people I heard it from. Because I know that I don't even know. I just know there's a big difference between me and them. But the difference is so big that I can't even gauge it. So our tradition is, as we look back and we read about the Rishonim, that the Rishonim were giants way beyond what we can imagine. You look back 900 years ago, so this story about a rabbi who had a car door close on his hand and he didn't react, so that's small fry compared to what they did 900 years ago. And there are stories, be it the Rambam's father, the way he stood up to the mullahs, I don't remember the name of the Arab tribe that invaded his town, be it the Rambam himself. There are stories of the giants of Israel and their tremendous, tremendous honesty and self-control and their tremendous midot, their tremendous kindness. And so as we go back in the generations, you reach an Amora, you reach someone written in the Gemara, no one's going to argue on him. You don't find anyone in the last millennium and a half that would say, well, the Gemara says this, I think differently. Why? Not because they aren't intelligent, but because they can appreciate how much stronger their tradition was and how great you had to be in order to get the title rabbi back in those days, 1,500 years ago. You go back another 200 years to the period of Tanaim. No Amora would argue on a Tana. So the Tanaim were held in such high regard, the rabbis of the Second Temple, and a little bit afterwards, that no Amora, known in time the Talmud, known in time afterwards, would argue with them. And the Tanaim, when they looked back at the people of the Tanakh, they looked at them and they said, we can't argue with them. They looked at them with a tremendous distance. So if you're going to take the formula we were discussing earlier, take a rabbi from today, multiply him 50, 60, 70 times, you get a rabbi from 600 years ago. Multiply him another 50, 60 times, you get a rabbi from 1,000 years ago. Multiply him another 50, 60 times, you start getting an Amora. You got to multiply him 50 times, then you get a Tana. Now you're going to talk about a prophet. You're not even talking about the patriarchs and their children, the 12 tribes. You're talking about something that's way, 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 way beyond what we understand. So then comes the Torah and describes in simplistic terms conversations between Avram and Sarah, between Yosef and his brothers, between Yaakov and Yosef. And you say, well, that seems pretty simple. It seems like sibling rivalry, just like I know. And it seems like favoritism, just like I know. So you have to pause and say, okay, I'm missing something in the picture. And this is where it gets tricky. In the classes, I repeatedly present the stories with the themes that Chazal wanted us to see in the stories. So I say it without stopping and saying, well, they were giants, and if Chazal say that Yaakov played favorites with Yosef, so we have to understand that it wasn't like a parent today playing favorites. You're talking about someone on the level of Yaakov, someone where in heavens, when they want the description of the ideal man, Yaakov is the one that's placed forward. It says on the heavenly throne there's a shape of a human, there's a shape of a human face, and it's Yaakov's face that's up there. Why Yaakov? Yaakov is Bechir Avot. He's considered tops over Avram and Yitzchak. Yaakov? We have so many questions about Yaakov. Taking the blessings in an underhanded way, dealing with Lavan in an underhanded way, now with all the kids, everything seems questionable. So the question is on us. We don't have a grasp. We don't have a clear understanding of who Yaakov is. And maybe I'm doing you a disservice by presenting the stories in simplistic form, but Chazal in the Midrashim and the Torah stressed certain points so that we learn certain ideas from them. Let's take a simple example, Yaakov and Yosef. Yosef is an orphan. Benjamin is brought up without a mother at all. And where did Yaakov play favorites? So the ketonet pasim, according to tradition, was that it had a slither of thread that the other garments didn't have. But that was enough to make him jealous. The jealousy of the brothers deserves a whole other class. Each point here, really, if we look deeper into the point, there'd be much, much more to understand. We don't have the time, really. We'd need a class each night to explore each point. The question between Yosef and his brothers and what their argument was all about. If you take your Chumash Bereishis, there's that much as you have in your whole Chumash, there's that much written just on Yosef and his brothers. Just on that, the relationship between them, what's really going on here. It's much deeper than we understand or than we can explore in this class. And Chazal gave us many, many, many insights as to what's going on here. For our sake, we're just taking these stories with a few messages that Chazal taught us. But when we speak about it in simplistic terms, we always have to interject, okay, I'm talking about someone who was not like me, and they weren't just running after their desires. And if we're going to learn about Yehuda and Tamar, so on a simplistic level, very nice, he's traveling uptown, and he just lost his wife, and there's a woman of ill repute trying to attract his attention. So of course he's going to run after her. Yes, but we're talking about Yehuda. If he was that type of guy, how come he's chosen to be the prototypical leader of Israel? And all the leaders, and in his blessing it says, you can't have a leader from any other tribe. He should be a leader? If you can't control your desires, you're not fit to be a leader. So the story obviously has much, much more depth. Instead of spending the time in each class expanding on that aspect of the story, what we're doing in this class is expanding on the what we'd call the regular messages that you guys have to know from the classical Rishonim. But whenever the Rishonim or the Torah speaks about the people, this introduction that we said today has to be interjected. We're talking about giants. We're talking about people that are way beyond our foibles, our material flaws. And yes, we have this description and we're supposed to learn this lesson, but we should realize that there's much, much more to be said. We're only reading it at a surface level. Yeah.
So
I want to add one more point. I have to say, what I just told you now, in different shades, I was taught throughout my elementary school education, and if I heard it maybe 15, 20 times before I finished high school, I didn't buy it. I spent the first at least 20 years of my life hearing it and saying, I don't buy that. I see what the verse says. And it was only over time when I started seeing that the masters of our tradition weren't less smart than I was, and quite the contrary. And I said, okay, I'm not the first person who asked these questions. And then I saw that the commentaries ask these questions, and the commentaries take it head on and say the verse really does say A or B or C. So how do our rabbis come along and interpret it differently? And then the commentaries go into it. But I'm saying it's normal if right now you hear it and you say to yourself, right, okay, so he's bought into it too. Fine, just bear it in mind, and over time, as you learn more, you'll see. Give it time. Yes?
Okay, so I want to ask a question, but I got to be careful about how I phrase it, because I don't want to be misunderstood. There's a halacha, I think it's on Tishbaav that you're not allowed to study Torah because it's gonna bring you joy. But like, I sit down and I read like the Parsha Shavua, and I said like, well, how can you be like happy about this? I mean, because you read like, how many tales are there really in the Chumash about like happy, you know, little tales of Shalom Bayit where like everything is good and everything is nice? You read that, you're like, you know, like, because it's like you read about Dina, and then you read about like how, you know, someone almost got sacrificed here, or this guy's wife, you know, Avram's wife dies there, and this guy's wife dies here, and then he's tricked by, you know, another person is tricked by Laban into marrying the wrong person, and like, what's the way of like approaching it that like you come away not feeling that, like, not feeling like you were just told another like crushing experience, like, you know, you come away almost scared that like, oh my gosh, if bad things could happen to them, you know, how much more so me? And then you come away feeling, oh no, what's going on, you know?
So that's a great question. I think it's a